Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, November 10th, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the Supreme Court case Tyson Foods, Inc. versus Bua Fakeo. Our expert is Karen Harned, who is at the court today for oral arguments. My name is Katie McClendon. I'm the Director of Publications at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our expert, Karen Harned, Executive Director of the National Federation of Independent Businesses Small Business Legal Center. Karen will give some opening remarks, and then we will open the floor for your questions. Thank you for speaking with us, Karen. The floor is yours.
Thanks for having me, and thanks, everyone, for being on the call today. So this morning, the Supreme Court heard arguments in the case of Tyson v. Bua Fakeo, and this is one of three class action cases the court has taken so far this term. This is the second one, I guess, that's been argued. In this case, Tyson's Foods was ordered to pay $5.8 million in damages in a class action lawsuit that was brought by employees who were alleging violations of various federal and state labor laws. The class consisted of 3,344 employees. They said that Tyson's failed to properly compensate them for the time they spent donning and doffing protective clothing and equipment, and also washing their equipment, walking to and from their stations. And the employee's expert used statistical sampling to determine the damage awards. So the court took two issues, or considered two questions, with this taking of this case. First, whether individual differences could be ignored when a class is certified under the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 23 or the Fair Labor Standards Act, and that class is certified using statistical techniques that presume each class member are identical to the average observed in a sample. And then the second question is whether the class, when a class includes hundreds of members who were not injured, do they have a right and don't have a right to damages? Does that class stand when you've got uninjured class members? So on the factual basis, this concerned a Tyson's plant, I believe in Iowa. They had, because the class members would, some would cut meat, they would have different types of equipment that they would use for that. Sometimes they would need to wash the equipment after their time had, you know, after their day was over. Some wore mesh aprons, some wore rubber aprons. Anyway, they had to put on protective clothing, you know, the donning of clothing, walk to their stations, and then after their shift was over, maybe wash their equipment, walk back, take off their clothing. But what Tyson's had argued was that there were 400 different types of jobs at this plant, and the variation among duties and what was required as far as clothing and even washing was very, very dramatically per each worker. So, for example, pre-shift donning had varied from 31 seconds to 13 and a half minutes. Post-shift donning had varied from under 2 minutes for some workers to 9.5 minutes for others. So, again, Tyson's had added 4 minutes a day to each paycheck. So there were definitely members of or workers there that came in within that 4 minutes, you know, every day and were not due overtime. And this was definitely proven at trial. It also, as you might have inferred from my setup, there were some, you know, workers that had to wash their equipment, like if they were using knives, but others, the plant washed, so they didn't have that responsibility at the end of their shift. So despite these material differences of fact, the Eighth Circuit have found that Rule 23 governing who is and who is not in a class allows class liability based on statistical sampling, even in cases like this where there's significant differences among class members. So Tyson's argued that under the Walmart versus Duke's decision that came out of the court in 2011, the court has been clear that certification of a class cannot happen under Rule 23 unless it finds, after a rigorous analysis, that four requirements are met: numerosity, typicality, commonality, and adequacy of representation. They said that faithful adherence to these standards would have resulted in this case not being certified because of the wide variety among class members and the type of clothing and protective gear they wore and whether or not they even washed equipment. And Tyson's argued that the use of statistical techniques allowed plaintiffs to airbrush away real differences among class members, resulting in compensation of class members who suffered no injury at all. The employees, respondents, argued that Tyson's failed to accurately report each of the individual's workers' time and instead simply did their own, sampling, if you will, or averaging, to come up with this added 4 minutes of time per paychecks for donning, doffing, and washing equipment. And they said that by failing to accurately report under this decision, under a court decision in 1946 entitled Anderson versus Mount Clemens Pottery, the employees are absolved from having to calculate exactly how many hours they lost, again, according to that case. And that case was another overtime case. That case was not a case under Rule 23 class action analysis. This was a Fair Labor Standards Act overtime case. So what happened in court today was, in my opinion and colleagues I spoke with after argument, probably not didn't make Tyson feel that great after it was over, quite frankly. There was a lot of discussion on Mount Clemens. There was very little discussion on Walmart. In fact, I think the only time Walmart ever even came up as a case was when Carter Phillips, who argued for Tyson's, raised it. And I say that because – and that's important because that really – those are the two cases that each side is pitting against each other. And there just seemed to be a lot of question about, how do we interpret, the facts of this case in light of Mount Clemens, which is definitely a case that would be more favorable to the employees in the case. So a case that had at first blush looked like it was going to deal with Rule 23 class actions and can you certify a class if you have non-injured parties and can you certify a class that is based on statistical sampling, I can definitely see a pathway after hearing argument today in which that issue does not get resolved, that instead the court goes to the Mount Clemens issue, the issue of when there's not individual by individual accounting of how long each worker is working when it comes to the donning and doffing time, can there be an averaging of that time and a Fair Labor Standards Act, collective action in which those employees can get compensated? And if that's the case, they might get into standards of, what kind of sampling works. And for all I know, they may even get into, what do you do when you've got these non-injured people that are part of your class. Right out of the gate, Kennedy went there. I mean, he started questioning Phillips on, why didn't you ask for a bifurcated trial in which you first assessed, liability and then went to damages? Why did you object to that? Carter later in the argument said, we never actually objected to that. The employees took that off the table. But the reason this is all relevant is because There was a lot of discussion, not with just Kennedy, but also the women of the court, particularly Sotomayor and Kagan, suggesting that you can deal with the fairness issue of who's getting compensated what on remand. Again, I think the bottom line takeaway after listening to argument, I mean, just, you know, it's tea leaves, so who knows, but is that there is a there's a decent chance that the court is not going to use this as an opportunity to further its Rule 23 jurisprudence, but instead maybe talk more about what it means to be a collective action under the Fair Labor Standards Act going forward. And in that instance, I could easily see them putting back and saying, you know, of course non-injured people can't be compensated, but that's for a district court to, or, you know, the court to decide, you know, through a further analysis on remand or something like that. I don't know. I mean, that's just a guess. But bottom line, it was a relatively interesting argument, especially because Breyer had his, you know, fun hypos dealing from everything from, I don't know, sneakers and antitrust to different colored rooms and having employees in different colored rooms working different amount of times. He was just quite entertaining this morning. But with that, that's really my conclusion. I'm happy to take any questions people have.
Thank you, Karen. I'll now open the floor to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say floor request mode has been initiated. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then pound. When we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt that will say your microphone has been turned on. You have the floor. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. And it looks like we have one now. So once you hear the prompt, then you can go ahead and ask your question.
Hello?
Hi, Karen. It's Pepper Crutcher in Mississippi.
Hey, Pepper.
Who are food processors? And I'm wondering, was there any discussion between the justices and Tyson Council about how particularly a food processor would track this time individually and the practicality of doing so?
It was only touched on briefly by Alito towards the end, who suggested that tried to show, I think at that point he was talking to the government attorney, that it would be very hard, truthfully, for an employer to do just that, and especially if you're going to put them in a situation where the employees get to, if they don't individually track, if they do what Tyson's did here, which is do an average, tack that extra time onto everybody's pay period, but then in this case, if you get it wrong, let, you know, the employees make, you know, the broadest of assertions is what Tyson's would argue, or the most generous of assertions as to what time was actually lost. You know, how is the employer ever going to be able to basically go back and keep two sets of records, essentially, one that makes it easy for them just to do the 4 minutes or whatever it is per paycheck, and then the other to, like, basically cover them if they get sued later, and tried to point that out. And I don't think there was a resolution at all to that issue, but I do think that was what Alito was trying to pull out, is this was – and also Carter said that in the beginning of his argument, that is exactly why this kind of averaging is appropriate under the Fair Labor Standards Act, because it would be – virtually impossible for an employer to follow an employee around for, you know, especially with the Tyson's workers, some of them do different shifts, you know, different types of shifts over a 2-day period. So you'd literally have to follow the life of an employee, you know, each individual employee for a couple of days to really get an absolutely 100% accurate picture of what their donning and doffing time was like. So I guess the answer is it came up, but there was no satisfying result to that other than it was posed as a problem.
Did I just hear you say that the government conceded the impracticality of individual measurement?
Oh, I don't. No. I don't know that the government did. That was Alito was the one
right.
trying to point that out. Sorry.
All right. Thanks.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. And while we wait for our next question, I'll announce our next scheduled Teleforum conference call, which will be on Monday, November 16th at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll host a conversation with Victor Davis Hanson about foreign policy. Please consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleforums on the Federalist Society website, fedsoc.org. And please visit our website to listen to podcasts of previously recorded Teleforums that you might have missed. While we wait for our next question, I have a question, Karen, about what do you see as the ramifications for other types of cases if, depending on how this case is decided, for example, on classes, in cases where some members of the class are not injured at all, what do you see as the practical issues there?
Well, again, I think based on argument, I'm a little concerned that the court may not even go there on Rule 23. However, I mean, one of the questions presented was, can you have a class certified under Rule 23 if you've got members that are not injured? It did seem like most, like, well, I would even say the majority of justices thought it would be unfair for people to be compensated if they weren't injured. I'd like to think everybody thinks that, right? That's common sense. And there are a number of these types of lawsuits that are happening, other class action lawsuits like this that are happening with where you've got non-injured parties. Shicardi, Phil Goldberg did a great brief for National Association of Manufacturers and some others on this and pointed this very fact out. They went through some washing machine litigation that's been going on where you have all front-loaded washing machines being lumped in together, users of front-loaded washing machines being lumped in together, regardless of the make and model of the machine that they use, alleging that, you know, they're being harmed from mold and odors, you know, that it didn't work properly because of that issue. Similarly, there have been class actions alleging that a car or truck has a defect that entitles all owners to compensation even when the vehicle has worked for years without incident. So there are more and more of these. Not surprisingly, plaintiffs bars, you know, finds these types of cases and tries to get as many plaintiffs as they can into them. And so I think there was a hope that by taking this case, the court might you know, shut down these lawsuits going forward. And I'm not convinced, and I think that could still happen with this decision, but I'm less optimistic that they're going to get into the Rule 23 stuff than I was after argument than I was before.
And again, we're in the Q&A portion of our call. So if you'd like to ask a question, press the star key and then the pound key on your phone.
Hey there, this is Hayden O'Byrne in Miami. I had a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess I'm sort of twisted around here. Forgive me, this is because I haven't looked at the briefing, but was the class here certified under Rule 23 below, or did it go up as a collective action? And
it went up under both.
It went up under both, and
uh-huh.
Was there any sort of discussion as to how they would distinguish, or was that the whole Mount Clemens issue versus the Rule 23 issue?
I think that was more like that was the Mount Clemens versus the Rule 23.
Okay. Do you go into
Yeah, it was kind of confusing. It is confusing, but yeah, my the question presented was a question of or. I think they basically tried to certify it under both ways.
And going forward, do you think that they might just limit this to collective actions?
Yeah, that's where I'm. That's what I think they're going to do with this case based on what I saw at oral argument today. But, you know, I'm not always that great at predicting the Supreme Court, so who knows. But but today, all the discussion, truthfully, really, I mean, I would say 95% of it really was on the collective action piece. Maybe not 95% because there was quite a bit on non-injured versus non-injured. But when they were talking about the certification, it really was more on the collective action piece.
Did anyone bring up standing at all?
You mean just the elements? Of, like, what part of standing do you mean? Like, do you mean – because there wasn't a question as to whether or not you can have standing if you're not injured. And that issue really wasn't discussed at oral argument today, though it was definitely in the briefing.
Okay. Now, I was just wondering how that connected with the other standing cases that are up right now as well in the class action.
I guess Carter Phillips did bring that in a little bit in argument today, again, aggressively in the briefing. But in argument today, that issue just really it presented itself, I think, once, but not – it was quickly moved on.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Anyone else who has a question can press star and then pound. And Karen, please feel free to add any comments that you'd like while we wait for questioners.
I don't know that I really have anything other than, I do think it would be, even if they just limit it to the collective actions, I think bright lines on these rules would be very helpful. Anytime, especially representing small business, we can get one of those would be good. I just don't know. I really don't know how they're going to decide this ultimately, even on the FLSA part today. It was just a really odd – the argument went a totally different direction than I thought it would. Again, right out of the gate with Kennedy truthfully questioning the trial tactics of the petitioners in the case and their decision not to ask for a bifurcated trial or oppose it. So.
All right. Well, seeing no more questions, do you have any final thoughts, Karen?
I think I'm good. Thank you for having me.
All right. It's our pleasure. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Karen Harnett for joining us today. And thank you also to our audience and those who asked questions. We welcome your feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Please join us for our next teleforum, a conversation with Victor Davis Hanson on foreign policy, and that will be Monday, November 16th at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.